have Mark Lyman, one of our former PI consultants here. He's going to tell us about inflation from magnetic variance.
Great. Thanks very much, and thanks for the invitation to talk. And yeah, I'm going to be telling you about this new, I'm not going to say model, but new, what we think is of a new paradigm for inflation, for getting an inflationary epoch. But I should just emphasize that one of my collaborators, Peter Adsed, will be applying for postdocs this fall, as will I, in fact, but not, I won't be applying for postdocs here because I already was a postdoc here. So anyway, so I can start with the relatively uncontroversial observation that whether or not you think inflation had to happen, the inflationary model does provide a good match to the observational data. The precy of which is given here, combining the WMAP. I think this is year 7 data with the SPT South Pole Telescope power spectrum, which while I'm at Chicago is the only power spectrum I'm allowed to show. The other high resolution CMB measurement I cannot speak of. That's a joke. anyway, but so the inflationary epoch, as this audience knows very well, is really more of a it's more of a paradigm. It's a paradigm or a list of requirements, really, more than any particular model. They have some rules of things that the universe and the matter fields in it need to, or scalar fields in it need to do, rather than a particular. It's not like QCD where it's sort of like you propose a theory and study it. It's you list some phenomena which you want to realize, and then you go out trying to realize them. And so those phenomena are preeminently that you get a long enough period of inflation, if you want to go with inflation, and then that you get perturbations of the right kind. So ever since Linde, Albrecht, and Steinhardt, the dominant paradigm for, or the dominant method in which we have gone about realizing those requirements is to imagine a scalar field dominating the universe's energy density. And in particular, imagine the vacuum energy of a scalar field dominating the energy density of the universe. And that vacuum energy is slowly decaying into the kinetic energy of the scalar field through a period of slowly rolling inflation. So the requirement is that you somehow have to arrange through your physics processes that you have a very flat or slowly changing potential. But most of us get our start in scalar fields as cosmologists by studying inflation. But if you started studying scalar fields, not inflation, you would be surprised by the claim, I argue, that you would have a very flat potential, because scalar fields in general want to develop potentials that are not so flat as they are required to be for inflation. Indeed, the quantum effects would prefer you to be in a fast-rolling trajectory. So this hierarchy problem that everybody knows about, where you need to keep the potential energy very high while the gradients of the potential very small. A super simplified model for seeing how that happens is called the eta problem, as I think almost everyone here probably is familiar with. But a really simplified way of showing how that can happen is the sort of conflict between what you can arrange at the classical level and what remains true at a quantum level. You just imagine a model with two scalar fields, one of which is heavier than the other, but then you have no reason why they shouldn't interact. So you imagine writing down generic interactions between them. And as a classical physicist, since this second field, this psi field, is a lot heavier than the phi field, which is your inflaton, you can imagine just saying, well, the psi field rolls to its minimum, stops there, and is done. You can imagine just integrating it out of the problem and forget it ever existed. And as a completely classical calculation, there's nothing wrong with that. But we know that we need inflaton fluctuations. And this is where the fact that the potential energy of the phi field is quite large comes in, because if the phi field were only had a very small displacement from its minimum, then this would be a perfectly valid calculation to do, and you could ignore the psi field. But since the phi field is in fact very, very highly excited, very far from its minimum, there's a tremendous amount of potential energy. And so gravitational effects will cause all of your scalar fields that are light enough to get vacuum expectation values of the size of the vacuum energy. And so what that does is it spoils your finely tuned very small mass for your phi field and introduces a larger mass, in fact, generically a Hubble scale mass. But a Hubble scale mass is exactly what you don't want, because one of the slow roll parameters is basically the mass, the effective mass of your inflaton, the second derivative of the potential versus the potential itself. And so, so long as your mass is of order Hubble, this is always order one, and it's always 100 times too big. So this is the sort of generic eta problem that you can, it comes about in many more sophisticated, complicated ways, people claim, but is a sort of a general problem for scalar fields. And so what I'm going to describe to you today is a way of, I think, a physical and dynamical way of slowing the roll of scalar fields in a way that doesn't require you to arrange for flat potentials ever. In fact, at no point in this talk will the particular shape of the potential matter for anything that I say, other than it has to be not, it can't be completely flat. It actually, relatively steep potentials work great for us and work great for this model. I will, in various points, plug in a particular potential just to make plots and things, but nothing here will require that particular form choice. And this new dynamical physics that I'm going to describe is an analog of magnetic friction that operates via Chern-Simons interactions. And so those are all fancy words, and so I'll go through that one step at a time. So first, the analog model. So if we step away from the cosmos for a while and imagine things that we all understand very well, but since this is the Perimeter Institute, I can just write it in action form, and then I could probably just stand here and talk about this. If I were Latham, I would stand in this slide now for 20 minutes and explain the physics in a beautiful way using my hands, and everyone would be enlightened. However, I'm not quite as gifted in that manner as some, and so I will have pictures next. But anyway, so we just imagine a particle, a charged particle in a 2D harmonic well, and then a magnetic field interacting with it in this way. So the picture of that is that, you know, you have your charged particle, and then its equation of motion are given here, where I've tossed in a friction term for beauty, not out of necessity, mainly because I'm going to want something to damp out fast motions later. And then, of course, there's the potential force. And you notice, of course, that in the absence of a magnetic field, the x and y directions here don't talk to each other. But in the presence of a magnetic field, there's the Lorentz force, the magnetic force that mixes these two equations. And it's that mixing that, in fact, will prove to be the important thing here. And so we can do a normal mode analysis of this system by looking at the two modes where the angular momentum of the particle is either parallel or anti-parallel to the direction of the magnetic field. Whenever the simple one is when they're anti-parallel, and then you basically have the Lorentz force balancing the centripetal force, and that normal mode has a size characteristic of the magnetic field. The other one is the celebrated, and so this is the Larmor mode, celebrated from plasma physics. The other one is whenever these are parallel to each other. And this is when the Lorentz force actually directly fights the potential force. And here the characteristic frequency of this mode is given by the potential, the size of the potential mu squared divided by the magnetic field. So you can see as you modulate the size of your magnetic field, you can play off of these two time scales. And so for small magnetic fields, this is the fast time scale. This is a long time scale. But you can flip those around. Anyway, but just, it's easier to picture this graphically. And so for a small magnetic field, basically what you have is potential flow with a little bit of a little tiny push from the magnetic field. So you just mainly just roll down to the bottom and everything's pretty boring. But as you crank the magnetic field up, you start to make orbits on your way down your potential. And indeed, whenever you get to the case where your magnetic field dominated, what you do is you go into a phenomenon called magnetic drift, where you're actually completely magnetic, the Lorentz force dominated. And the other mode completely damps out. And so this is the reason for the friction, because otherwise I'd have oscillations going all the way down here. And so this is a very long and slow spiral down your potential. And so you've managed, through the addition of a magnetic field, to take something that has a steep potential and make it into a very slowly moving system. And so this is a, you know, three-dimensional system with a vector magnetic field. But this is the physics, the analog physics of this is what I'm going to use to realize slowly rolling inflation. So how does that work? So in inflation, you can't use vector fields because scalar fields are homogeneous and don't point anywhere, and they're not like particles that are rolling in cups. And so you need something a little bit more sophisticated, and what I'm going to be using is Chern-Simons interactions, which are the anti-symmetric product of field strength tensors. Or in less fancy language, like an ENM is just the scalar product of the magnetic and electric fields. So they're not that crazy of a thing. So Chern-Simons interactions are, if you don't think about them every day, if you aren't the kind of person who studies gauge theories, you usually are not compelled to think about them. And the reason for that is that they are total derivatives in the action, and they carry no stress energy, so that on their own, they're kind of boring physics-wise. However, whenever you have pseudoscalars around, scalar fields that can interact with gauge fields, then you notice that that if you have an interaction where you have a scalar field multiplying a Chern-Simons term in your action, then if that scalar field has a shift symmetry, then this term also has a shift symmetry. Because if you add a constant to your scalar field, then you just end up with the bare unadorned Chern-Simons term, which is a total derivative and doesn't contribute to your action. So you're done. So since shift symmetric scalar fields are nice for many other reasons, this is a good interaction for them. And yet once it's there, you have a means for transferring energy between your scalar and gauge sectors. So something that's going to end up operating very similarly to the Lorentz force. And yet this combination, much like its parent interaction, itself contributes no stress energy. So gravity doesn't see this energy exchange directly. So you can in principle make this a very large conduit of energy transfer without, in fact, spoiling the, potential domination. And we'll go through that in detail. And so the key here is that, remember, so this is a total derivative, then it's a derivative of something. And so whenever you multiply it by a scalar field, you can integrate by parts and get something that looks like a derivative of your scalar field times that other something, which is the analog of the Lorentz force. So that's the sort of trick of what's working here. And so the idea then is to realize this magnetic drift phenomenon using a Chern-Simons term instead of the Lorentz force. And so basically in the equations of motion for your scalar field, basically balance off the Chern-Simons force, which appears in this way, against the potential force. So to make this concrete, we can pick an inflaton. So if you have a shift-symmetric pseudoscalar inflaton, what you have is an axion. I guess you can imagine doing something else. And so for concreteness, we'll just imagine doing inflation with an axion, because it's a well-studied system. And for concreteness, even though, as I've emphasized and remains true, the shape of the potential will not matter to anything that I say. For concreteness, we can just choose a potential, because we do need for the potential to be non-vanishing. So if it were exactly shift symmetric, of course, the axion would have no potential. We need inflation to go, and we're still relying on the vacuum energy of the scalar field to drive inflation. And so we do need some potential, and so we might as well choose one that's well-studied and simple. So we take the sinusoidal potential of natural inflation, which arises from, we know that, yes?
So how important is the shift symmetry? Because you mentioned at the beginning of the talk that this would be a mechanism by which you wouldn't have to care about large quantum corrections.
Yeah,
but you did. Usually I introduce the shift symmetry because I'm trying to explain why there aren't quantum corrections.
Right. No, so it doesn't actually matter. The shift symmetry is actually not that important, it turns out. It's just, in fact, I'm not sure why I emphasize that, other than that the only advantage to the shift symmetry, it doesn't actually matter that much, to be honest. Yeah. In practice, no, it doesn't. Yeah, it isn't going to be, in fact, play a very important role. Other than, I think that the only reason it would play any kind of a role is if you want to come up with a concrete model, which is where we're trying to go with a particular model. Then you want something where the form of the potential is controlled, so just so that you can have reliable predictions. Because these parameters will come into the predictions at some level. Because you have to, I mean, even though you could easily just as well do it with another potential, you have to have some way of picking the scale of the potential and also its steepness. And so having a controlled potential where you can know that these are sort of like robust relationships between the fundamental parameters and the predictions is nice, but it's not necessarily it's not actually required. Yes.
Is the vector actually massless?
No. In fact, we will be using we'll be using a non abelian gauge vector, a gauge field that's intrinsically massless that it gets, but it gets a dynamic mass. Yeah. But it does have to, I think, the mass has to be sub Hubble if it does have a mass. So I'm not going to probably go into that today. Okay, so then to go about doing this, so Chris sort of anticipated my next couple of slides, but I'll go through it anyway. And so you might ask, what gauge field do you want to use? So electromagnetism is an old friend of us all, and so you might think you try doing that. If you try doing that, you would get an email, angry email from Lorenzo Sorbo saying I did that in 2009. But the problem with using the electromagnetism is that E&M is not really well suited to realizing this magnetic drift phenomenon when interacting with the scalar field, because there is no way to make a homogeneous background electric and magnetic fields in E&M that can interact via a Chern-Simons term simply with your scalar field. So they do still interact via Chern-Simons interaction, but what you end up getting is quantum emission of photons through this interaction. So you still might think, well, maybe I can make that work. So they tried really hard, but to get the right amplitude of perturbations, you need 10 to the 5 gauge fields. And so the simplicity, relative simplicity of choosing E&M is sort of spoiled by the fact that you have to say E&M 10 to the 5 times to get things to work out right. And they have to be distinct E&M gauge sectors that somehow, most of which vanish by the time you get down to low energies. And then also the spectrum is blue generically. And even though you might imagine, so you certainly can imagine accommodating a mildly blue spectrum with the data, you're going in the wrong direction. So, and the other thing is there's really no reason to do that because we know that we have non-abelian gauge fields around. We know this very well. And it turns out that non-abelian gauge fields are great for this purpose because as was discovered around 1980, so around the same time inflation was found, but for the first time, I think we've brought that has gotten together with inflation, that non-abelian gauge fields generically have homogeneous and isotropic background solutions on FRW backgrounds, as long as they have an SU2 subgroup, which all the SUN gauge groups do. And so, so basically, if you take this ansatz for a non-abelian gauge field, where you take a temporal gauge choice, and then basically assume that the background gauge field is just time varying, but not spatially varying. These solve the equations of Einstein-Yang mills with this electric and magnetic, chromoelectric and chromomagnetic fields. So you might wonder why you can do that. You might hold up your hand and say, "Hold on, I thought gauge fields are always vector fields," and they are. But if you have an SU2 subgroup of whatever your Lie group is, which you always do for these gauge fields, then that is isomorphic to SO3, which is the spatial rotations in 3-space. And so you simply can identify through the use of a Kronecker delta here. This is the magic happens here. It's a sort of topological configuration where the gauge field, where any spatial rotation in real space is undone by the rotations in gauge space and vice versa. And so you can set up a situation where the gauge fields, even though they're intrinsically vector-like, have a solution that has no spatial direction in space picked out. So it's quite cute. People didn't know what to do with it for a long time. It's kind of fun to read the old papers when they say, this probably has something to do with cosmology, but they never do anything with cosmology with it. But anyway, so there it goes. So you put these things together, and you get chromonatural inflation. Where you have, now I've realized it, I've realized the promise of the previous slides, and now I have a particular potential force plus a very particular Trans-Simons interaction plus a coupling constant lambda, which will allow me to tune up and down the strength of the magnetic force versus the potential force.
Yeah. You might have thought that there would be a solution that just had A0 turned on and not the AI's turned on. Is it possible that that's doable for this
situation? Yeah, it's possible. Yeah, you might be able to do it that way. Though you might not have enough gauge freedom to do that, right? Yeah. I mean, you might be able to do it. You know, there might, you can probably do a gauge choice. I mean, if such a thing does exist, it would just be a gauge redefinition of some kind. It just seems like it'd be a little harder to see. I don't know. so what you need for this, but if you want the scalar field to be slowly rolling, what you basically need is for this combination to be about equal to that one. So and it turns out that you can guarantee that merely by taking lambda v large. And so the way to see that is to write down the equations of motion and then solve them. And what you do is the trick to seeing it is that you do the typical slow roll thing where you drop the accelerations of all of your scalar fields and just solve for the velocities. But here you have a real scalar, an actual scalar field, not real in the sense of real, but an actual scalar field, and then this sort of quasi-scalar field thing that is the field that parameterizes the strength of the background electric and magnetic, chromoelectric and chromagnetic fields. And if you solve these equations, which are, they start out being coupled in the velocity, but you can, whenever you make the slow roll approximation, you can diagonalize them for the velocities, and what you see, you get a bunch of stuff on the right-hand side, plus velocities times something that looks like the ordinary Hubble friction, plus a magnetic friction term, and this is common to both. And that magnetic friction term is exactly what you rely on to get your magnetic drift. And so basically what you're going to do is you're going to take lambda to be parametrically large, and then divide through, and then you can make the velocity of your scalar field small by making lambda big. But what you notice whenever you go through this in detail is essentially that you can't do this. You can't make both of these velocities small. So there's a lambda squared here, and only lambda to the first power on the right-hand side for the scalar. So the axion here, or the scalar, is always going to evolve slowly. But the gauge field has a lambda squared force and a lambda squared damping, so it will evolve fast. And so you might worry that it's going to evolve fast to zero. But it turns out that it has a non-zero fixed point, which will allow this to proceed. And then as long as psi is around, then your axion or scalar field will slowly magnetic drift slowly. But then you can turn lambda up here with abandon, at least in the gravitational perspective, because the Trans-Simons term itself is not carrying stress energy. And so that fixed point, it turns out that you can write down an effective potential, an approximate effective potential for this gauge field psi. And if you look at it, in the absence of this Trans-Simons coupling, the gauge field would just like to roll down to zero, as you expect. It wants to just dissipate its energy. But the way this is all working is essentially that the force, the V prime, for the axion, which is, this is mu to the fourth sine, is the potential force of the scalar field, is dumping energy preferentially into the gauge field whenever lambda is large. And so as opposed to slow roll inflation, where all the energy, whenever you just have a single field slow roll, then you have to make a very flat potential because you just have to have a very mild force so that the Hubble damping is sufficient to slow down the scalar field as it gets pushed by its own potential. Here, you can have, as long as you have a very efficient transfer of energy from the scalar background field into the gauge background field, you can make this potential as steep as you want, and it just pushes all of the energy into the gauge fields where it safely can be dissipated. But the really nice thing is that as it does that, it settles it into this fixed point, which is exactly the fixed point that sets up this magnetic drift and the very slow evolution of the scalar. And so what you find generically is you get a trajectory where the evolution of the scalar field basically goes like 1 over lambda, and then dimensionally is of order h squared. And it's this velocity is independent of the derivatives of the potential to this order. And so the only thing that changing the shape of your potential changes is the size of the fixed point. So you can imagine screwing that up, I imagine, but it's kind of tricky to do. F is the axion decay constant, so it's basically the steepness of the potential.
Right, so your chi-naught is proportional to F.
That's true, but this is just basically this is the range over which chi goes, and this is its speed relative to that range. And so if this is 100, then it always takes characteristically 100 times the Hubble time to get to move across its range. So that's the UX. It's a rescaling. Yeah.
What was G tilde?
Well, G tilde is the non-abelian gauge coupling.
G without.
It's also that. It's just it's a bit of nomenclature confusion. Sorry. Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Why did it? Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. The one G tilde is still left. I guess. Anyway. Yeah. So they're the same. Neither is the square root minus GG. Okay. Thanks. Anyway, so you can do the same. You can plot the same thing as the magnetic field analog example, and what you see is that here you really are seeing very similar physics, where you have a potential here, and you go through a fast Larmor phase as you damp out the high speed oscillations, the rapid normal mode, and you go through the. And then once that normal mode is completely damped out, you go into a situation where you're entirely dominated by the drift mode. And you slowly evolve down your potential. And so in slightly more familiar language, you can imagine, so the effect, let me see. So here, around this fixed point, the psi field has an effective mass that's about three times, that's not about, it's exactly three times Hubble. So this is so while this process is going on, this is sort of looks like a heavy extra scalar field that you can imagine integrating out. And even though you can't really, really do that because it's only dynamically realized into this heavy state, and so it's not an actually heavy field, it turns out you can get a pretty good approximation for the dynamics by integrating it out. And then you get a system that is entirely an axion on an effective potential, but where that effective potential basically looks like this, where it's extremely flat, except for right at the top and right at the bottom of its original potential. So basically, as long as it has enough of a gradient to force this magnetic drift to happen, then you have a very flat, slow roll, and you get this. This is an approximate solution for the dynamics, but it's a very, very good approximation whenever you do it numerically. So you can see that the number of, and then you can just go ahead and invert that and solve for the number of e-foldings, and this is how you can sort of tune your parameters. And so it turns out there's lots of choices that work. And so that basically, if you start at the top, for this parameter choice, which is the one that we found in the paper that gives, we think probably will give the right level of perturbations, then you can sort of have 110 e-foldings if you start at the top, 55 e-foldings if you start about a third of the way down the potential, and then 10 e-foldings from the bottom. So the only reason I show this is to show that this is probably, as long as the delta n formalism intuition that we have, that is that the perturbations of inflation are going to be governed by how much closer to the end of inflation a perturbation takes you, then what that means is that to have a red spectrum, what you need is for perturbations early on inflation to have more consequence than perturbations later on in inflation. And so what you see here is that if you have a relatively constant size jump in delta chi or delta axion, then that's going to make a bigger difference in your total number of e-foldings early on than later. So this should be generically red tilted, just as in regular inflation. But you can do a parameter study, and it turns out that these parameters don't matter too much. So I mean, you can vary them over wide ranges and still get plenty of inflation. And don't necessarily need to take you through this, other than to note that this is sort of an interesting one, where that if the G, the gauge field coupling, is proportional to mu squared, which is the energy scale of the, if numeric, yeah, to the rescaled energy scale of the potential, then it turns out that the total number of E holdings is independent of changing either of those. So there's a special relationship between the two numbers. Yeah, so lambda, so the max, so go ahead.
I was just wondering how these numbers compare to just for those parameters, the potential by itself without this coupling.
All of the, so the potential, so we've chosen F to be 1% of the Planck scale. And so in natural inflation, to get enough inflation, the smallest you can go is about the Planck scale. So this is 100 times smaller X and decay constant than you can. And this is, by the way, just as a side note, I forgot to say that natural inflation by itself does work fine as a single field inflation model if you're willing to accept an axiomatic case constant F of order or larger than the Planck scale. But there's this famous problem that no one's been able to ever realize that in string theory. It's very hard to get these long axion trajectories to be realized in any kind of stringy construction. So it's sort of an impediment to taking those models absolutely seriously. Though, in a sense, axiom monodromy and these things are a way of, are attempts to make that happen. Anyway, and so just as a curiosity that you can take from that previous interesting realization that these things, this seems to be the special parameter combination, and just look around and you see that, in fact, whenever g squared over lambda is equal to 1/3 mu to the fourth, which is basically the Hubble scale at the very top of the potential, This turns out to be the maximum number of E foldings. It's the slowest of evolution, the most perfect magnetic drift. And so, what this tells you is that basically how much you need to tune lambda, because the maximum number of E foldings is about 3/5 lambda. And so, if you start way up, quite very close to the top of the potential and go down. And so, the minimum that you can let lambda be is about 100. So then you'll get 3/5 of 160 E folds. And so that's about the level of tuning you're going to require.
Is there secretly an absolute body-warm Kainon?
No.
So if it goes negative, then it looks like we have.
Oh, then if you flip everything over, it's a parity-violating theory because the trans-Simons term is a parity-violating term. So if it goes negative, then you have to flip signs a few other places, and everything goes through the same. You flip the sign on psi too.
That's okay. Like what an entire secret.
Say what?
That's effectively what I meant by secret.
Yes, secretly it is. Okay. I thought you meant was the square root of a square, which was. But yeah, Matt.
So are you going to talk a little bit more about how inflation ends in these models?
Yes, I'll get that in a second. Yeah, and it has a very graceful exit to inflation. But let me just first emphasize that we've solved the eta problem. If everything else works fine, this completely solves the eta problem. The safer the potential doesn't matter. The hierarchy you need is this, and it's set by lambda. But that's a technically natural hierarchy. If you can find a way of setting lambda to be large, then you're done. The Trans-Simons terms don't generate higher order corrections of the same form because they're total derivatives, and so there is no the series in that direction terminates after the Trans-Simons coupling. Yes, Kurt, are you going to contradict me?
Yeah, so you're not demanding a shift symmetry.
No.
Want to be able to write an arbitrary potential?
Well, so there's kind of two ways. One is you can stick with the shift symmetry perspective and say that you're going to have some kind of axion that has a special form of potential, and you can control it, and then you understand everything that's going on. Or you can sort of step back and say that this mechanism is so powerful that I can instead find any scalar that's going to couple via the Trans-Simons term and go to town.
So if you say that, you want to allow an arbitrary potential.
Yeah.
Then you have to worry about terms that are like
chi
squared times
f. Yeah, presumably. I guess you could worry about that. Yeah. Yeah, if you don't, right. So yeah, that's a good argument for sticking with things that are shift symmetric. But yeah, good point. Any other questions? Anyway, so but as written, if you stick with shift symmetry, it's a technically natural hierarchy. So you haven't stuck so far, unless you do something else, as Kurt rightly points out, you're completely safe here. So before I go into the end of inflation, and though this will lead into that, there's a couple of concerns that people have when I get to this. Often, whenever they start thinking that this is too good to be true, oh, didn't I think of this, blah, 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 this can't be right. And so the first thing people often say is that, well, you know, it's a non-abelian gauge computer, it should confine, the whole universe is going to be a proton. Haha, I've defeated your model. And so I've had almost that exact interaction, at least once. But it doesn't. It turns out it's completely fine. You can if you take the gauge shuffling to be relatively small as relative to the other scales, you can basically tune the scale of strong coupling or confinement to be bigger than the Hubble scale. And so basically, if you think of this as being something like a confining gauge field, just the whole universe is smaller than the confinement scale, the horizon is just smaller than the confinement scale. And so you're completely content to live on that small scale. And then whenever you, in fact, it's great to confine at the end of inflation because that's a great kind of process to end inflation with. Much better to end with a bunch of gauge fields going through nonlinear processes in inflation and there's a lot of worse ways from a reheating perspective to end inflation. Another thing that people worry about sometimes is that there are some well-known IR instabilities to these two non-abelian gauge fields. If you try to set up various configurations in flat space, then it turns out you can't in ordinary flat space set up these large-scale configurations. But here it's actually not a problem. If you look very quickly, you can see that there are tachyons that appear. These tachyons are either projected out by the gauge constraint or cured by the interaction with the axion. So as you go to higher gauge groups, things get a lot more complicated. So if you imagine trying to embed this in an SU3 SUN theory, where you start with a larger gauge group and just take a subgroup, identify that with the spatial rotations, and try to tell the whole story, then it gets more subtle. It looks like it should be OK, but it's a lot harder to analyze. And so if you stick with SU2, you're totally fine. And SUN is something we're still working on. Just to finish saying that, even if you don't worry about confinement, you end inflation with radiation domination naturally. So I mean, by which I mean that you have gauge fields. And so what happens is the potential eventually gets to be small. The potential energy of the scalar ends up being smaller than the gauge field energy, which is parameterized by g squared psi to the fourth. And so what you do is if you plot the time rate of change of the gauge field energy versus the gauge field energy, you have this kind of interesting phase plane plot where this is inflation, all this black line. So you're sort of slowly moving through this phase plane. And then when you get down here, you go through a transition where this happens. And then you have it kind of goes through this wild phase orbits at the end. And presumably other things start kicking in if you put in more physics. But so inflation is with radiation domination, which is what you want.
So you mentioned at some point in the beginning, it's hard from just being slow.
No, it's okay.
Doesn't contribute to stress energy.
Correct.
So at what point does that start to become an important contribution?
That never becomes an important component of this turntime term itself never does anything. What it does is it's basically always doing is funneling energy from this. This term into this, which is the, and for non-abelian gauge fields, this is just the background energy that comes from the F squared. Yeah. So this is just F squared versus V of phi, or V of chi. And so F squared eventually gets bigger than V of chi, because this goes to zero. Does that make sense? Sorry, I didn't really spend any time explaining that before, so it's not. Anyway, so that was all 4D effective physics. So it turns out that you can, if you want to step up and try to do this with more than four dimensions, that in string theory say, it actually turns out to be relatively straightforward to do. And so saying you can realize your model of inflation in string theory in a straightforward way is always something I've aspired to be able to say. And I think I can say that right now. It turns out that I'm going to give a concrete example. I'm told by string theorists who know these things better that there are a bunch of examples that look like this because these Chern-Simons type interactions with scalar fields are very common in string theory. For concreteness, I'm going to imagine taking two of the gauge fields of string theory, the B and C bulk fields. So the B is a bulk two-form field, C is a multi-form field, and they both live in the bulk, which is that is to say they live in the they can live in all, any of the dimensions. So I'm just going to imagine that I take, say, one of the fields, the B field, and point it in two of our large dimensions. And the C field, I'm going to say, is points in one of our big dimensions plus some of the little plus some of the little dimensions, but it's not, the details of that aren't going to matter too much for the background. And so then I can write down, so it turns out, so in, say, the more fancy words, the in type 2B string supergravity, or type 2B string theory, the supergravity solutions have this form for a D7 brain whenever it is interacting with these fields. If you just imagine turning these gauge fields on. And so the 4D effective action looks like this. And so it's gravity plus the two effectively form fields. They're simpler here because they're not non-abelian fields. They're just regular old abelian gauge fields. And then there's the scalar, and then your Tern-Simons interaction among these. Again, of course, importantly, the Tern-Simons piece is not isn't going to be carrying stress energy. And so you can just go ahead and analyze this system.
What is the scalar field?
So here we're just imagining it's the position of the D7 brain interacting with these bulk fields. You could do it with axions in a very similar way, but this we're just taking. And so this, it doesn't depend very much on the details of the compactification, again, because the form of the potential can be whatever you want. You just kind of imagine that there is some D7 brain that's displaced from the minimum of its potential. And importantly, we don't have to, in the non-abelian case, you have to imagine starting out with the gauge field also in this configuration. So you have an initial condition thing where you have to arrange for the gauge field to be excited as well. Which may not be crazy, but non-abelian gauge fields take a finite amount of sort of activation energy to get going because they have this g squared psi to the fourth energy cost to setting up a background field. So for abelian fields, though, there is no energy cost to exciting them. They're massless. They're completely massless, even around backgrounds. And so it turns out that the solution I'm going to describe is a dynamical attractor. You can start with the gauge fields just turned off, and all you do is just displace your D7 brain. The D7 brain's motion by itself will, in fact, if you allow this to go, and if this coupling has the right hierarchy of scales, will displace you from your potential flow and move you into the magnetic drift flow generically without doing anything. Though I'm not going to go through the details of that. It's in our paper. Anyway, so you go through the very similar process here. Once you have the 4D effective action, the string theory is over. You can all breathe a sigh of relief and carry on calculating, and you just make a similar ansatz where you take the B field and you give it, you parameterize it by A squared, the scale factor, times B, and then C is one copy of the scale factor times C. And so then you again make the slow roll approximation and diagonalize the velocities. You again get these things that are lambda proportional lambda squared. These are the magnetic drift terms. And then you can inspect the right-hand sides and see that, again, the scalar field has at most one copy of lambda, whereas the gauge fields each have two copies of lambda. So you'll have two fast-moving modes and one slow-moving mode, and so you have magnetic drift. So what you get are, again, fixed points for both B and C, which are, again, proportional to the gradients of the potential. And then, again, the scalar field's velocity is proportional 1 over lambda. And so this is, again, the same ratio showing up. So this is what you always have to arrange. And so this doesn't necessarily mean that lambda is large relative to whatever the scale that you're setting here is. It just has to be large relative to H. So you might have worried here whenever I mentioned that I have two vector-like fields that I was going to be introducing anisotropy in my system, because I made sort of a big deal with a non-abelian case that I was making a homogeneous and isotropic background. And so I was sticking with the thing, what we know about cosmology, which is that the universe is pretty darn homogeneous and pretty darn isotropic. And so various attempts made over the years to realize models of inflation utilizing vectors have run head-on into the fact that if once you pick out a special direction in space, like the direction that the C field points as a relative to this B, this combination of two directions the B field faces points, then you've broken isotropy, and you might have problems with observations. And so here, if you just from an intuitive perspective, you might not worry quite so much, because unlike in vector inflation, you're not getting inflation directly from these vector fields, but you're just using them as sort of an energy loss mechanism. And so, but nonetheless, you really want to do the analysis to make sure that you aren't treating these directions in space differently. And so that we did using this way of parametrizing a Bianchi, an axially symmetric Bianchi anisotropic metric, where the sigma is a constant of the motion, as it turns out, whenever you only have one free direction, it doesn't have independent dynamics. And so you can just directly solve for what the size of the anisotropy is in the system. And it turns out to be of order epsilon, so of order of slow roll. So that's kind of a nice number, because we haven't measured the anisotropy of the universe to better than a couple of percent yet. And so it's something you could imagine like going out and possibly observing, but it's relatively small. And I should say that even though that's a sort of hopeful statement, when we do the numerical thing, it turns out to be sort of like, you might hope, hey, it's maybe 5 times epsilon. But the numerics, it seems to be like a percent times epsilon or a tenth times epsilon. So it's a very small number. So, but we haven't really done a systematic exploration of that, nor have we really calculated in great detail how that feeds back into observables like perturbations. Because
that's today or at the end of inflation?
At the end of inflation, yeah. So but presumably it would be over the whole range of scales, and so that it would be there during the CMP. So we haven't actually gone through the in detail. It's just this would be at the end of during and in the end of the inflationary epoch. What would be residual? Yeah.
Would you expect there to be some tending necessary fluctuations to be isotropic?
So,
the inflaton is decaying, and then the B field and the C field differently.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. No. This is the sort of thing we haven't gone through the details of that calculation yet, so we aren't quite sure. But one of the things is that even though here I imagine there being one special B field that was pointing in one pair of directions, generically I think generically you would expect that there would be sort of like several sets. It would be a sort of a superposition of the B field pointing, the B field getting excited into some generic configuration, as would the C. They would only interact with the scalar through these special combinations that are picked out by the Chern-Simons interaction, but. In the details might be a little hairy. And so it's certainly something to worry about. The sort of zeroth order thing looks okay, but yeah, it'll be fun to sort of, it's one of the things that once we figure out how to do all the perturbations, we want to do all the, work out the details of this with more care. It would be nice in a sense, or not nice, it would be disappointing, but it would be very concrete if it didn't make very anisotropic perturbations, so then you could just throw it out. And then you'd be forced, if you want to do something like this scenario, to use a non-abelian gauge field. And so I have been dancing around a little bit this perturbation story, but mainly because we haven't completely finished it yet, because it's very hard. Let me just remind you that how things go in the usual story. So what we're pressing for is that you imagine that in the usual case, you write down the equation for the fluctuations of a scalar field on the sitter or on any background effect. And what you have is this combination, which is like the effective mass. And what you need is for the effective mass, m hat, to have the form such that you get the late time scaling of the field in conformal time to be just right, so that they're expanding along with the accelerated expansion of the universe. And so you want these runaway, almost exactly massless perturbations, which can then survive outside of the horizon and go on to grow up to be CMB perturbations. And so that, in practice from this, as is very well known, what you basically need is for the mass of the scalar field to be really tiny. But you already needed that to make inflation happen. So it's sort of one of the things that you can go hoorah about the slow roll flat potential case is that what you bought with the tuning of your potential was not just the background, but also the fluctuations. And so that's one of the things that's so nice about the flat potential story. And so you might worry that in this more complicated story that there's going to be a very much more complicated perturbation story. But what you really, the first thing you really want to worry about is there a flat direction? Will you have the kind of fluctuations that you need? And it turns out you do, always. Intuitively speaking, you can guess that you're always going to have a flat direction because you have a fixed point. And if you had fluctuations in both of the fields that preserve this fixed point, then that would give you, that would have basically no cost. And so it would be just like it would be a massless fluctuation. But it would be nice to see that in the equation, so I'll go through that. So basically, if you write down the generalized equations for fluctuations in the, so chi is the fluctuations in the scalar, and beta the fluctuations in the background overall gauge field. And I should say the reason why I'm sort of couching this in not final answer terms is because for gauge fields, you don't just have the background fluctuations to worry about, but you also have all the other vector degrees of freedom and other scalar, there are other scalar degrees of freedom. There's many more degrees of freedom in gauge theories. We're pretty sure that none of those matter.
They seem mostly
to be massive. In the non-abelian case, they seem mostly to be massive and therefore nothing to really worry about. They do couple, but it seems to be at a lower level. Doing the non-Gaussianity calculation will be an interesting endeavor. but they seem to be fairly safe. But sort of dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's turns out is very hard, especially because it turns out that gauge fields too. Well, I'm getting into the weeds. Let me finish this and then I'll come back to it if you want. Anyway, so basically here, let me just go back and just say that so the right-hand side here is again is the new piece, the Chern-Simons bit. And what you're going to want is for this somehow to guarantee you a light direction. So you can do the same analysis and look for late-time growing modes for both the scalar field and gauge fields. And so just looking at these equations, it's not clear whether that will exist as it was before. But it turns out, at a first glance, it's not clear. But then, at second glance, it is, in fact, clear. Because remember that lambda over h is the hierarchy we've already tuned. So much as in the usual case, we've already pre-tuned m to be small, here we've already pre-tuned lambda over h to be big. And so what we have is a large number of times something that is 0 when alpha equals minus 1. So remember, alpha equals minus 1 is what we're looking for, at least one mode that's light and growing at k equals 0 at late times. And so basically, and everything over here is not big relative to lambda over h. And so what we have is this the second equation is always solved by alpha approximate equal to minus 1, because anything divided by a big number is about 0, and this is about 0. So what we have, again, is that The tuning we needed to make inflation last long enough has guaranteed us the existence of a late time growing mode. And so that is a nice bit of physics that you might even say that you might always have to have something like that happen for a slow roll to proceed, but I'm not willing to go quite that far. But anyway, just to summarize and conclude for now, though I'll be glad to take more questions. That I hope I've convinced you that that magnetic drift physics is sort of a qualitatively different way of getting a slow rolling epoch, and that you can do this with Chern-Simons interactions in scalar field dynamics. I've given two concrete examples in 4D with this chromonatural model, and then one string theory candidate, a particular string theory candidate model, though you could imagine starting from that standpoint and going on to making other models. And we definitely have these kind of the right kind of perturbations, though getting the amplitude right has proved thus far elusive, though we're working hard on it. And with that, I'll close and take any questions. Any more questions? Thanks.
So from a string point of view, what am I doing to get large lambda?
So you basically just have to, it's a matter of picking, of tuning of the extra dimension sizes, volumes, and stuff. We have the details in our paper. I don't remember them off the top of my head. It's not crazy to do it. I think let me just try to recall. The hierarchy, it amounts to choosing various, it depends on the particulars, but it's like, what is It has to do with various volume forms, like the volumes of different of subvolume forms or something like that. I can't remember the details right now.
Okay, I'll have to look at this. I thought that would be the universal between two terms, so I'm surprised at that.
It'd be,
you said you worked it out.
What did you say first?
Well, so I would thought that term would be universal between. You started with the tending, you got usual terms plus the transcendence term.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have normally thought, well, the volume term.
Right, you wouldn't have anything left to do. Right, yeah, so that was an early concern of ours, but it turns out there are things to tune. Because the thing, I guess the important thing to remember, I guess, in a certain sense, is what you're trying to get a hierarchy essentially between here, this, and this. So those aren't guaranteed to be the same. Even though you can't do much to tune the size of this directly, it's just you can sort of monkey around with the hierarchy between the two, and that's what you end up having to do. Because lambda itself doesn't have to be a big number. It just has to be big relative to the Hubble scale. Yeah.
Yeah, so you have this gauge field in the homogeneous background.
Right.
It's still a gauge field.
Mm-hmm.
Is there, you might think that you could also, instead of normal curvature fluctuations, get shear stress.
Okay. What do you mean just by like vertical modes?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's not possible, but it seems like you can have anisotropic stress.
Mm-hmm.
In principle.
Yeah. No. You certainly could in principle. Yeah.
So,
the gauge fields. Yeah.
You need to instead of tracking, you're only tracking curvature fluctuations.
Oh yeah.
You get quantum fluctuations of the shear stress.
Absolutely. Yeah. That is why we're not finished. Because we're keeping track of all of the modes, all of them, which there are many, and there's various different ways of breaking it down. We're still not quite sure what the best way is, but yeah, those are all there. They all do get quantum fluctuations. They all seem, yeah, they're definitely all there, and all have to be worried about. We don't think they're going to lead to any big problems for the power spectrum, because this light mode is sort of a special thing.
But they might give you something different, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, right. Absolutely. And they are all there, and they do all have to be worried about. Yeah.
That's one thing that is a follow up sort of is so if I understand it correctly, you get this homogeneous solution by identifying an internal group with
mm-hmm.
rotations.
Yep.
So all the magic is in the delta function.
In a sense,
can you perturb that a little bit?
So I mean, so the perturbations don't respect that background choice. I mean, don't respect that special solution.
But I mean, if you don't choose a delta function, you choose some other element.
You mean a sort of set up a background that doesn't quite identify it?
Yeah. Is that a meaningful thing? Or?
It's a good question. Presumably, it would add another mode on. So you could probably decompose it into the mode that exactly relies it, and plus enlarge perturbation on top of that or something.
Something goes wrong with the solution. Because in that delta function, the gauge indices there had to be those of an SQ2 subgroup.
Yeah.
Choose them to be something that's not an SQ2 subgroup, something must go wrong.
You know, exactly. No, that's why I was trying to figure out how to articulate even the procedure that you're suggesting, because it's like, yeah, because there is something that you, there's something, because it's sort of, it's not exactly topological, but it's sort of like setting up a monopole, and then it's sort of like
it's something like you know, you've got all these electric and magnetic fields, but you're gauging away the direction only.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a way of saying it, yeah. Yeah. So it's hard to know how to make a small perturbation away from that. I think it's sort of a special configuration. So the only thing I really know to do is what we are doing, which is to take that and then look at whether, and then just do classical perturbation theory on top of that and look at whether it's stable or unstable to the growth of small fluctuations that don't respect this special identification. So in this setup, it looks like it is stable. So the thing is that it's a wildly unstable system, actually. But so is all of inflation, because basically you have an exponentiating volume. So all you have to do is it's like outrunning the bear. You have to, all, if you have to have your, your special mode going faster than all the competing modes, and that's what it seems to be happening. That you have a bunch of other modes that are conceivable, and even you might even imagine making them grow, but they're not growing fast because the background is going really fast because it's an exponent. Because the gauge field energy is having to be fed very rapidly to keep it exponentiating. And so you're speeding it, and the turn time transistor likes to feed it into this background mode because that's the one that is like the homogeneous scalar field, that background mode that is driving inflation. So that you have that energy transfer going on, which is picking out this background mode as special and feeding it, and so that other modes have trouble competing with it.
Thanks.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Touch on the
non-gaussing
energy.
Sure.
Do you have any expectation of being able to control?
Yeah, that's a question.
Are you worried about highly non-gaussing? You kind of repeat that.
Yeah, no, we worry a bit about that, yeah. So we do worry a bit about that. We don't really have any way of thinking about it yet. The one non-gaussian calculation we kind of know how to do is that it's not directly related to us is the quantum emission of gauge photon. Which is just the one, because it'll go through and be very similar to the Enver and Sorbo calculation. That should be relatively the same, even though whether you're using gauge photons, whatever gauge photons you're using, or gluons or whatever, gauge quanta. And for that, you get sort of a level of non-Gaussianity that's potentially observable, but not very big. In FML terms, a few, I think. And that's a very back of the envelope kind of taking our parameters and plugging it directly in their equations without, you know, squinting just enough to match the ones that seem to be right, but not working too hard to make sure that it's really the right thing to do. But if that very rough calculation is correct, that tells us that the quantum thing is not going to make it run away. And so then you have to worry about the feedback in the classical level because it is a nonlinear system. And for that, I would say that the thing that keeps me from worrying too much is because there is this light direction is a special thing that's sort of like keeping the identification of a fixed point. And so what you would be worrying about for the non-Gaussianity is sort of two physical things that happen that are pretty big. So they could have a very strong interaction of that light mode with itself. And that doesn't seem that we don't. It doesn't look like there's anything that would allow that to interact strongly with itself. So I could be missing something. The other thing you might see is something more like a local type non-Gaussian, where you have sort of like a strong decay of a curviton or something like that. And that is definitely not there. So the sort of standard wave physics of non-Gaussianity, it doesn't look like the kind of terms are in the action that would drive that. For instance, because this is a very mildly curving trajectory in the phi versus axion case, or in any of these cases, these are not exactly directly straight trajectories, but the radius of curvature is really small. So if the thinking that has been done, which is that curvatures on field space can lead to non-Gaussianity is correct, and that if that does port over here, which is an open question. But if it did, these radii of curvature are relatively small too. So, but that leaves open the huge door, which is what about other kind of physics that can lead to non-Gaussianity? All these possible terms, and I just don't know the answer to that. Other questions?